Once I started digging into the literature, I saw a lot of literature back in the 1950s to 60s where people had used germ-free models and tried to study the effect of microbes specifically on GI physiology. And it seems like there was this hiatus of 20 years where we started to believe that we can't really culture microbes, so we can't really prove the Koch hypothesis. And so, you know, people just moved on. And as sequencing became more popular and more accessible, and as data analysis became more accessible, I felt like this is an area where we do need to go back and take a look because we have new technology.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a nonprofit scientific organization also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And we're delighted to be joined today by Dr. Parnat Kashyap of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and Parna is a gastroenterologist and obviously has a lot of interest in the gut, and particularly in chronic diseases of the gut. Parna, can I ask, what first attracted you to working with or on or about the microbiome and the bacteria and the archaea and the viruses that live in our gut and their role in chronic disease? What was the kind of bit of compelling evidence, if any, that drew you into this topic?
Thanks, Colin and Dan, and thanks for inviting me. And, you know, it's a good question. So going back to where I started, I developed an interest in this during my fellowship. I trained with Genrico Ferrugia, who, you know, was leading one of the important areas within GI physiology. And so that was almost my first introduction to molecular mechanisms underlying changes in GI physiology. At that time, I got interested in microbes more so because we used to talk a lot about it, but we never really saw any real investigations. And then once I started digging into the literature, I saw a lot of literature back in the 1950s to 60s where people had used germ-free models and tried to study the effect of microbes specifically on GI physiology. And it seems like there was this hiatus of 20 years where we started to believe that we can't really culture microbes, so we can't really prove the Koch hypothesis. And so, you know, people just moved on. And as sequencing became more popular and more accessible, and as data analysis became more accessible, I felt like this is an area where we do need to go back and take a look because we have new technology. At that time, the studies which were coming out were largely associating diseases with different changes in the microbiome. So we could say it was the very first foray into microbiome research back in 2007 to 2008, where people were describing these changes in different disease states. And it was intriguing because every study seemed unique, because every study found unique features in the microbiome associated with a different disease. And so I felt I was not well qualified to be able to investigate this area because I didn't really have a background in microbiology. I felt I had good training in physiology, but not in microbiology. So when I joined on staff in Mayo Clinic, I applied and was given a Mayo Foundation scholar, which allowed me to venture out of Mayo for 2 years and learn something new and bring it back. So I opted to go to Justin Sonnenberg's lab in Stanford, who was a microbiome aficionado at that time. He came from Jeff Gordon's lab and he had started his lab in Stanford. And I figured that's where I need to start. And so I spent 2 years in his lab. And once I had a good understanding, I came back to Mayo and I set up my lab, and I try to combine the two areas, my passion for changes in physiology and my clinical practice, along with how to study the gut microbes, not only at a sequencing and composition level, but also trying to investigate its molecular as well as physiologic effects.
Of course, the Sonnenbergs are, you know, have a wonderful setup there at Stanford, and you couldn't, I don't think, go to a better place to learn. The thing that always strikes me about people seeing differences, let's take the example of people with IBD versus healthy controls or almost any gut disorder. To me, it seems trivial. I mean, the gut environment is a bit different in somebody who has an inflamed gut with IBD compared to a healthy gut, and therefore the microbiome is different. But it would be extraordinary if it wasn't. I mean, it seems just a 1 and 1 equals 2, but there's no suggestion of causality at all in that relationship. What brings you to think that maybe causality is involved rather than just simply the different environments selecting for different microbiomes?
A great question, right? And, you know, this is, so I have a different view on this in terms of causality. We think of causality as being, you know, cause and effect, right? And that's it. We don't think of causality as an ongoing cascade of events. If we were thinking of the traditional infectious diseases, you get a microbe, you get the disease, you remove the microbe, and the disease is gone. But that is not the case for chronic diseases, where there's not a single factor that's involved in the causality. We can't say gene or genetic defects cause IBD. We can't say environmental changes cause IBD. We think that it's interaction between multiple host, genetic, environmental, dietary factors, which means that each individual will have his own path to a disease. And that one individual, there might be a more strong genetic component, another there might be an environmental component. So that means that a disease could be triggered or started by one of these mechanisms. And then it comes about perpetuation. So you made a good point. Inflammation is going to perpetuate a certain kind of microbial community, and that's going to vary among different individuals based on a lot of factors. But once that community is there, it's in its best interest to stay there. You know, microbes are survivors, and once they take hold, they're going to try to make the environment more conducive for them. So we would expect those microbes to then want to perpetuate the inflammation. Now, do we call that causality? I would say yes. I mean, if a community is thriving in an inflammatory environment, but is also perpetuating inflammation at the same time, I think that's the case. And, you know, I had a conversation with Gene Chang in University of Chicago about this once, and we actually landed up doing a study. In fact, he did the study looking at whether a community which is adapted to constipation, you take that and you pass it on to a new environment, will that perpetuate that phenotype? And we found, at least in a mouse model, that it does. So to some extent, it tells us that what starts the disease, especially in chronic states, may not be as important as the factors that continue it on. And we know this from the pathophysiology of you know, DGBIs, that it's not one thing that we can point out and say that's causing that particular phenotype.
I think that's a great answer, and I agree with you 100%. The thing, if a patient or somebody with IBD is listening to this, they're going to think, then there's no hope because it's caused by so many different things and perpetual. Where do you think the best, I suppose, you know, if you were the right fulcrum, you can move the world. But where do you think is the right place to intervene then? Is it diet, environment? We can't really at the current moment intervene with the genome of the individuals, or the microbiome, or do you have to change everything in order to break out of that cycle of IBD that you described?
And I'd like to add to that question, Perna, given that we maybe don't know the right levers because we haven't looked all along the GI tract and haven't looked at all the possible molecular markers and things, what we need to learn more about in order to better answer that question?
Great. And you know, I'm going to editorialize a little bit because I don't think there is a right answer or wrong answer here. So it's a good part. I don't think, you know, what I'm suggesting is that there is no hope, right? What I'm suggesting is that there is a hope in terms of the fact that we can break the cycle. We may not be able to reverse course all the way, but that's exactly what we've been doing all this while, except we've been doing it in a non-specific manner, which is, if you look at most chronic diseases, we don't target the actual pathophysiology, we target the manifestation, right? I mean, we try to target inflammation, we try to target transit, we try to target the symptom, but not the underlying pathophysiology. And that is important because patients are here today, and we can't tell them that, you know, in 40 years, we'll figure out how the disease is made, and, you know, then we'll treat you. Till then, just hold tight. So I think it's important what we're doing right now. So the first idea is to be able to treat patients effectively. Yeah. Then comes the question of where should we target? You're right. The host genes are not that amenable or easily amenable. The reason the microbiome became more important was that it was considered to be something which could be changed, because we see changes in the microbiome across the lifespan. But I think what we underestimated is our ability to change it. And it's, while we always say the microbiome is changeable, we don't realize that it's not that easily changeable, which means that a microbial community, just like I mentioned previously, is going to try to maintain its current state against intervention. So it's not so fragile that you try to give a antibiotic and then that everything is gone. Yeah. It's going to reconvene very quickly, and it's going to try to maintain its current state. So we need to understand better of how a community support itself to try to disrupt it, rather than trying to just make an addition or subtraction and expect that the community is going to start moving. So I think what we've learned, and I don't think we've done anything wrong. I think we obviously tried low-hanging fruits earlier to try to change the community. And we realized very quickly that what we see in animal studies in terms of the effect of diet or microbes on a microbial community is not the same as we see in humans. And that's because the humans are simultaneously exposed to multiple factors as compared to mice, where we can control all the factors. So I think the idea is that we understand the community is modifiable, the community can be targeted, but it's not as straightforward as adding or subtracting. Now, we do have the bazooka approach of just giving a fecal transplant and changing the whole community together. And, you know, that seems to work in certain infectious diseases and in certain other people. The second point, which I'm going to try to address with Dan's question in terms of what we need to do, I think what we don't do very well as scientists and as investigators is we don't acknowledge our failures very well. When we do a clinical study and you don't see the result that you want, you either don't put it out or you try to convert that into a positive somehow without acknowledging the fact that there are reasons why people don't respond. It doesn't mean that the drug doesn't work. I think we've seen this in drugs. Wherever we try to look at a drug, there's a placebo response, which may vary, and then there's a drug response. But we're looking for an increment of about 20% or 10% or 30%, which means that 30% over placebo respond, but the rest don't respond, which means that there's a large proportion which is not expected to respond to these. So when we get these negative studies, which are small, we need to be able to learn to figure out who is responding to them and why are they responding to them. And I think that's where I feel like we don't do a good job in trying to figure out why people respond to certain interventions and why they don't. Because I don't think going forward in 20 years, we will see this idea of one size fits all, which we've been using currently, where we give a drug and the same drug to everybody. Some people respond and others don't, which was to be expected from the initial results. And then we go to the next drug and we say, okay, we've got a few more who respond. And then we keep moving on, because we do need to do a better job of trying to figure out why and how people are responding to a intervention. So to your point, I think it'll take some time to figure out how to alter the community and then also how to alter it in different people. It's not going to be the same approach. It doesn't mean that we'll have to come up with a new therapy for every patient, but definitely for groups of patients who have similar underlying biology, we might have to group them separately as compared to how we group them now.
Yeah, one of the insights you have, Perna, that I appreciate as a mathematician is that different metabolites may have opposing effects on a receptor target. And so the net benefit, so to speak, is sort of the difference between the agonist and the antagonist. So, you know, you could look at just the people that have the net benefit, but ideally you would actually be able to quantify how many of the metabolites are having an enhancing effect and how many are having a detrimental effect. And the technologies you're pursuing seem like they may have potentially give us that ability to do that.
Yeah, so it's a great point. I think at least even in a small time of my career, I've seen people have become a lot more collaborative and cross-disciplinary, but I feel we need to you know, notch that even one up at this point, because there are groups which are very good at large scale studies, looking at in silico models of trying to figure out a metabolite and the drug targets. And there is that data which exists out there where you have microbial metabolites and all potential drug targets. There are clinical studies where people have profiled metabolites or microbes within each state. And then there are preclinical models where people have studied the effect of individual metabolites. Now, if we could in some way combine all of these three fields, which are functioning in their own silo, I think we have a trove of information right there, because if you take an individual and you, let's say, have an increase, I'll give you, take an example, which is the most common, I guess, a decrease in butyrate, and you see a decrease in butyrate across multiple chronic diseases. Now, butyrate is a global regulator, which probably affects multiple targets. The question is, let's say it decreases the receptor concentration by its epigenetic effects, but there are multiple ligands in one individual for that and only one ligand in the other. So then, you know, you need a low butyrate level, and then you also need low levels of those ligands to have a biological effect. And I think that's the nice part about human biology. We don't just fall apart because one thing changes in our body. We have multiple competing or compensating pathways which will take over.
And Karna, I was fascinated by, you know, some of the things you've been saying there. And do you think we're going to reach a point where, you know, as microbiologists, as scientists, we have this tremendous urge to name things and classify them and put them in boxes and, you know, look at who is in your gut. But obviously, I think it's trivial to say what's much more important is what they're doing. So you may have a bacterium in you producing butyrate. I may have a completely different name of a bacterium doing it in me. So we really need to get beyond our instincts, which are to name and shame, and the kind of Koch's postulates idea of we will identify single organisms or even little clusters of organisms that are responsible for things, to the idea that we need to look them, you know, in terms of their functionality. They're looking more at maybe metabolomics than microbiomics. Is that kind of what you're thinking along those lines?
Yeah, you know, so that for the most part, that's exactly where I have been focused on and trying to identify metabolites, because I always felt that they are the drivers of microbial effects. And as you mentioned, each individual harbors different microbes, but at a functional level, there appears to be less heterogeneity. So I still believe in that, and I still believe that metabolites are driving a lot of the physiologic effects. It's important to understand which metabolites and how they're driving it. But when I think about how metabolites change in an individual, that's not just a microbial input. So it depends on whether the diet provides an input for the microbes to produce it. You need the microbe which can produce it. And then you also look at the host, if the host is going to lap up a big chunk of it. So for example, tryptophan is a good, you know, dietary molecule, which we all need. The host will need it to produce serotonin and kynurenine. So majority of it gets taken up by the host. And then you have now competing organisms, which may produce indole, which may produce tryptamine. And so the relative amounts of each of these would depend upon how well they can compete with the host, how well they can compete with each other. And of course, if you don't have microbes which can produce it, then you won't get it. So if I was to say tryptamine, which, you know, we studied, is something which is important for a phenotype, and we need to increase, we should maybe just give tryptamine. We can't give it that easily. The advantage of microbes producing some of these metabolites are that you would expect less off-target effects as you see with drugs which are given systemically, because these would act in the gut. Two, you know, tryptamine, as we've done with other molecules like butyrate, when we give it just in the pure form, it doesn't seem to have the same biological effect as when microbes are producing it on a more continuous and dynamic basis. So there is, I feel like we need to know why a certain metabolite is low, because butyrate or tryptamine could be low because a person doesn't consume any protein or fiber in the diet or consumes very little, or it could be because they don't have the microbes to do it. So when you're trying to intervene in these individuals, if you don't know what's driving the low level of their metabolite, you won't be able to intervene. So that's why I always say that it's not that the who's there is not important. I just feel that that's not enough.
Yeah, and it's not just one of the things that you very well know and have tried to teach other scientists about. It's not just the low level. It's if there's the low level in the right place. Like the, it matters very much where in the tract you're having the activity or you're not having the activities.
Yeah. And to me, the context definitely matters because each metabolite is not just acting on one receptor or one pathway. It can activate multiple pathways. Butyrate can do a lot of things. Other metabolites can also have multiple effects. But if, let's say, an individual has normal epithelial barrier and there's no dysfunction, a metabolite which improves barrier function will have really no role in improving the barrier function. But if they have slow transit, that same metabolite, if it improves transit, then it might change the transit. So I think if there is no abnormality, giving a metabolite in that individual will not change. We can't make somebody super normal by giving something which has a biological effect, right? So the underlying context and where it has an effect matters, but it will vary based on what the GI environment of the host has.
And Parnik, can I ask, I mean, most of the gastroenterologists I meet professionally are at microbiome conferences or at ISAP conferences, and maybe I'm seeing then a biased group. If you go to a card-carrying gastroenterology conference, is it just universally accepted that the microbiome is a player in chronic diseases, or is it still a bit of a kind of, you know, some people think it, but most do not? Or where do you think it falls now in terms of gastroenterology, you know, the way gastroenterologists think about the gut?
So I'd say there are believers and non-believers, right? And people who have worked with GWAS for the whole life, you know, they believe that there is a dominant component of genetics. People who are in the microbiome field always feel that it's important. So there is always some lip service to the microbiome where you say that it's important, but it ends there, because I think in a lot of gastroenterology conferences, we need something is important to here's how we treat it. And as soon as we start having treatments, the conversations will amplify. And that's what I'm hoping now that we have some FDA approved treatments, albeit only in C. difficile, I feel the conversations will amplify because people now see a path by which this connection can actually be leveraged to treat patients. Because till now, it was always this, you know, we've tried probiotics, they don't work. We've tried prebiotics, they didn't work. You know, it's not important for an average gastroenterologist as to why they didn't work. It's very important for people who are working in the field as to why something did work and did not work. And so we need to figure out that. But as soon as we have something which works and is out there, people's interest goes up. So, you know, that's why I said I'm cautiously optimistic that now that we start seeing approved therapies, that we will be able to reinvigorate the field on all levels, not just...
Well, what's interesting too, Parna, is that, you know, you've kind of noted that you can't necessarily just introduce a specific microorganism and think that that's going to achieve benefit. So a specific probiotic, for example, may not cause a restoration of a disordered gut microbiome. But either introducing communities, which are sort of what the fecal microbial transplant, but which I don't know if you endorse that too strongly or not, but I know you do endorse a healthy diet with fiber, with the idea that that's not necessarily going to increase the production of any specific microorganism. It's going to promote a healthier community. Is that a fair way to describe how you feel about the microbiome itself? Is it's a community it's an ensemble?
It is, right? And yeah. and so I would obviously a different approach if I wear a research hat versus a clinical hat. So from a research perspective, I feel any intervention is very relevant. I think FMT is very important if we were to leverage it as an intervention and figure out why some people did well and what was it that changed in those people versus what did not. So I think we've known from a long time, interventional studies are hugely informative if used appropriately. So I think whether it's in animal models or in humans, I feel there's a lot of benefit of interventional studies, whether it's introducing a single microbe or a community of microbes, because it's an opportunity to study what happens when you give that. At a patient level, I don't endorse yet giving targeted therapies for the microbiome because I don't have enough evidence around them. So I don't tell them that they should take one versus the other. The idea of a high fiber diet really comes where I'm not really telling them anything new. I mean, the guidance that we have currently is to consume 30 to 35 grams of fiber, and an average American diet is around 15 grams of fiber. So at the very least, I'm asking patients to get to the point where, you know, where our guidance lies right now, which I feel would be good for the microbiome, but it's also going to be good for their overall health, because fiber has benefits beyond just the microbiome. So, you know, I'm not pushing for specific microbiome targeted interventions in practice yet, just because I don't have enough evidence to support it.
The rise in these chronic diseases like IBD over the last 70, 80 years, you know, we can, there's the hygiene hypothesis, which suggests that the, you know, the decline in infectious disease, the increase in sanitation and hygiene has been mirrored, if you like, in reverse by these, the rise in chronic diseases. That would argue somewhat that the microbes are really important in triggering the disease, and as you said, in prolonging or maybe exacerbating disease. Do you think that is real, or do you think changes in the environment or changes in the diet over that similar period could be equally responsible or exacerbating factors?
I think obviously I'm going to come out as biased, so I do endorse that view, right? Because I am in this field, and that's been one of the areas I feel strongly about. But I think for me, it was also important from a different perspective. If you look at migrants from developing world coming to developing countries and developing a higher risk inflammatory bowel disease or inflammatory conditions and autoimmune conditions, while you see a decline in infectious diseases, as you would be expecting. So you have your own human experiment with migration across continents, which also supports that view. So I think it's important. So the question is, are we trading one evil for the other? It's hard to know. So I would not say that I would want to be exposed to multiple infectious agents to get rid of autoimmune disease, but I feel like the microbes do play a role in both, and how we approach them will vary. And that's why I felt geography matters in terms of how you target the microbiome in maybe a developing world versus more developed countries, because that approach is not going to be the same.
Yeah, I noticed you were a co-author on a really interesting study that used mouse gut to see the impacts of a human diet and a rural Thailand diet. And it wasn't so even so much the microbial communities per se, but you also even showed that the mucosal thickness was affected and things like that. So,
yeah, for me, that's a starting point where we can go. And I think we keep forgetting that the field is young. You know, we want answers yesterday, but I think it has to, you have to give it time. I know this is like the Amazon Prime era where everything is delivered in 2 hours, but I don't think science is at the same pace where we can deliver therapeutics at the same pace as companies.
Yeah, I think we took half an hour to come around to the usual conclusion of any scientific discussion: more research is needed, which, you know, is where we nearly always end up. But of course, you're absolutely right. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Parna. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Parna. I really appreciate having excellent clinician scientists like you that are advancing science and figuring out better ways to treat patients.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice, or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.